Welcome to Island Crimes and Mysteries. And now, it's time to join your host, Nules, for another episode.
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story. Now before I start, I would like to thank Sharon Kelly, my latest Patreon member. Thank you very much, Sharon, for your support. It's really appreciated. I'd also like to give a shout out to my buddies over at Rainy Day Rabbit Holes podcast, who are doing amazing stuff. I hope you're all tuning in and listening to them. I look forward every week to their latest installment and the great stories they have over there of all things history and all things quirky from the Pacific Northwest. So guys, if you haven't already, go over to Rainy Day Rabbit Holes podcast and give them a listen. It's a great little podcast. Actually, do you know what? I'll let them explain themselves. They'll do a better job than me.
I'm Shay.
And I'm Jody.
We host the Rainy Day Rabbit Holes podcast, a deep dive into the misty mysteries of the Pacific Northwest.
From the untold stories of eccentric pioneers to the secrets buried deep in the moss-covered forests, we take you on a not-so-serious journey through the quirky tales and hidden stories of the region.
On our show, you can hear great content like...
Dr. Dewey's teachings propelled Linda Hazard into a lifetime career of starving people for money under the auspices of healing.
I could do that.
Run a cult or...
Both.
And thoughtful insights like...
Doll's son Charles is burned and poor Sparky is killed. RSVP poor Sparky.
No, not RSVP, RIP.
Oh, sorry.
From coffee pioneer Starbucks to feet on a beach and even Bigfoot, we have something for everyone.
So grab your latte and hit play. Listen, learn, and laugh with Rainy Day Rabbit Holes.
See you down the rabbit hole.
Today's case brings us back to Waterford City and to the year 2006. Waterford City lies on the southeast coast of Ireland and is in driving distance of some of the most beautiful coastal villages, sandy beaches, coves and cliffs in the country. Heading out of Waterford down to the Copper Coast, you will discover places like the small fishing villages of Dummer East and Ardmore, with fabulous scenery and some mouth-watering restaurants. If you want to keep the children entertained, head to the seaside town of Tremore, where there is plenty to occupy the children and adults alike. If you want to chill out in the sun or take a dip in the ocean, head down to the beach, and a trip to the amusements is a must. As you explore this beautiful part of the country, you will come across the Waterford Greenway. This is a 46-kilometre stretch of pathway from Waterford City to the gorgeous seaside town of Dungarvan. You can hire bikes and go for a cycle along the Greenway while taking in the amazing views of the Cumber Mountains as the pathway hugs along the river shore. And if history is your thing, then a trip to the Dunbrodie Famine Ship, which is moored in the town of New Ross, is a great day out. You will experience what it was like for our ancestors as they embarked on a new life in foreign lands. The conditions they had to endure as they set sail for the promised land. You will also see the emigrant's flame that burns brightly and permanently on the quay beside the famine ship. Now that's just a snippet of the places you can visit if you're in Waterford City. There's plenty more on offer for everyone. And it is here in Waterford City that we will find 42-year-old Meg Walsh, who was living there in 2006. But to understand how Meg, who was originally from Fermoy in County Cork, ended up in Waterford, we must go back to when Meg was just 19. At the tender age of 19, Meg married a man named Coleman Keating after she discovered she was expecting their daughter. But after 10 years of marriage, cracks began to appear. Despite the fact the marriage was becoming increasingly strained, they decided to go on a holiday to Crete. Here they had met up with some other Irish people also holidaying on the island. In this group of friends was a man named John O'Brien, who was from Tremore in County Waterford. He was on holiday with friends from work after a recent divorce himself. He worked for Bus Éireann, our national bus service. On one of their evenings out socialising, Coleman had had a bit too much to drink and wanted to head back to their apartment early. But Meg did not want her night to be over and wanted to head into town to check out the clubs. She asked John O'Brien would he accompany her, and he duly obliged. And over the course of the evening, one thing led to another. When they returned home to Ireland, the affair continued and they would secretly meet up at weekends, Meg often driving from Cork to Waterford to meet him. This secretive affair would not remain secret though for very long, as they would both be caught out when Coleman noticed the repetitive number that was John's on their phone bill and rang the number to find out who it belonged to. When John answered the phone, Coleman recognised the voice. This would be the final nail in the coffin for Megan Coleman, and they separated. After her separation, John and Meg decided to move in together. And this was when Meg made the move to Waterford, with her daughter remaining in Cork with her dad. She would visit her mother regularly though. Meg would get a job in a place called Meadow Court Homes, who were building contractors, and she was employed as an office manager. Meg longed for a bigger house, so they bought a house in a new development which was being built on the Dunmore East Road called Ballinakil Downs, just outside the city. These were luxury detached houses and Meg was thrilled with her new purchase. She looked forward to visits from her daughter, who would have her own room in the large new house. Then in June of 2005, Meg and John would get married at a local registry office. Despite being known as an outgoing, friendly lady, Meg was not well known in her new neighbourhood. All the houses in the estate were not yet occupied, and those that were mostly vacant during the day as people worked. So neighbours generally kept to themselves, politely acknowledging each other, but not really getting to know each other. John, however, was well known at the local hotel, the Woodlands, which was situated on the Waterford Road. They would go to the bar there to socialise regularly, as it was in walking distance of their home. It was here they would be also socialising on the evening of Saturday, the 30th of September 2006, with friends until the early hours of Sunday morning, when it was reported they left the bar to head home with another male friend in their company. When she was last seen, Meg was noted to be wearing brown jeans and a brown jumper with a light stripe on it. She had told some friends that she would ring them the following day, but this call was never made. Then on Monday, the 2nd of October, Meg failed to show up for work. Her work colleagues made a number of calls to her phone, all of which went unanswered. So at 11 a.m. that morning, the decision was made to contact the Gardaí. Gardaí immediately began searching for the missing Meg. Meg had been known to the local Gardaí as she had made reports in recent times, which added a layer of urgency for the Gardaí to locate her. They interviewed her family and friends, anxious to understand Meg's state of mind at the time of her disappearance. All would say Meg was in good form in the days before her disappearance, and on the last night she was seen as well. Then on Wednesday, the 4th of October, Meg's car, a Mitsubishi Charisma, was found parked in the car park of a local bar called the Uluru. This was approximately 2 kilometres from her home near Ardkeen Hospital in the city. The car had been last seen at her home by a neighbour on the Sunday evening. No one had seen Meg driving the car after that, and the neighbour was unsure if it was Meg who was actually driving it at the time. After the car was found, an extensive search of the area was undertaken within a 5 kilometre stretch. This also included her home, with John asked to vacate the home and he went to stay with his sister in Tremore. Gardaí then sealed it off for 2 days while the technical bureau went through the house with a fine-tooth comb. An unmarked Garda car kept note of everyone coming and going from the estate. An extensive search of the Dunmore Road also took place in the area near Ardkeen and the Uluru car park, with checkpoints being set up. Gardaí asking motorists if they'd seen anything unusual or concerning that could be of help to the investigation. Then on Friday, the 6th of October, Gardaí appealed to the public, asking them for information about a man seen driving Meg's car 2 days after she had disappeared. It had been established that the car had been parked at the Uluru on the night of Tuesday, the 3rd of October. Gardaí were anxious to identify this man and also establish the activity of the car in those 2 days. CCTV from around the area was collected and the car was forensically examined, with Meg's blood being found inside the car. One of the floor mats from the car was found by Gardaí discarded in a field near the car park when searching that area, and blood was also visible on that too. This did not bode well for a positive outcome in the investigation. That field was then cordoned off and forensically searched, but according to reports, nothing else of note was found there. Garda Sub Aqua team searched the river shore along the Waterford Harbour out along the shore estuary, as well as the coastline along Passage East and Dunmore East. Her bank account and mobile phone had shown no activity since the 1st of October. Some of Meg's friends were interviewed for the newspaper and said it was totally out of character for Meg to just disappear like this, saying she would always tell someone where she was going, saying everyone was really worried about her and what had happened to her. It was then reported in the newspaper that a few days before her disappearance, Meg had rang the Gardaí in a distressed state, saying she'd been attacked by a man known to her, and that he had also threatened her, but she did not want to press charges. She just wanted it put on record in case anything would happen to her in the future. The paper saying he was now the prime suspect in her case and that it was now expected to be upgraded to murder. This man, according to the paper, was being kept under supervision by the Gardaí at a local hotel. The report went on to say there were fears for his safety. He had first been contacted by the Gardaí 24 hours after Meg had gone missing, where he had had an informal interview with them before being released. He was suspected of carrying out 2 serious assaults on Meg in the months prior to her going missing, with one of these assaults resulting in facial injuries after Meg was kicked in the face. She was admitted to hospital with minor injuries after another assault by the man 2 weeks prior to ringing the Gardaí. Accompanied by a female friend, she called to the local station to make a complaint about this man. She again stated she did not want to press charges, but she just wanted the assault on record. She would tell her colleagues at work on the Friday before she went missing that she lived in fear of this man, and if she did not show up for work on Monday, they were to call the Gardaí. This was the reason her colleagues immediately rang the station when she did not show up for work on the Monday. Later, Gardaí would tell the press that they still had no indication as to where Meg was, and as each day passed, they were becoming more concerned for her well-being. They again appealed to the public to come forward with any information they may have, saying, "Someone out there has information that held the key to finding Meg." During the search for Meg, over 300 people came out to look for her, with fishermen checking the coastline with their boats and farmers checking outbuildings and their land. The Civil Defence, the Defence Forces, Waterford Sub Aqua Club, as well as the Coast Guard also volunteered to help in the search. Tidal areas around the coast were examined and the search continued to concentrate on the 5-mile radius around her house. On Thursday, the 12th of October, Gardaí released photos of Meg's car to the public, hoping someone would remember seeing it in those 2 days following her disappearance. Waste ground near her home was searched and Gardaí from neighbouring counties were drafted in to help. Then on Friday, the 13th of October, her daughter and brother would issue a joint statement at a Garda press conference saying, "We are desperate to find her and have her back," they said as they appealed for help in finding her. Her daughter saying the last time she saw her was the weekend of the 17th of September. They had spent that weekend shopping and having dinner before her daughter went back to Cork for school. Meg had then arranged to visit her daughter in Cork on the weekend of the 7th of October. Neither her daughter nor her brother knew anything about the alleged assaults that had taken place or the fact that she had reported anything to the Gardaí. Her husband John also made his own appeal separately to her brother and her daughter. Speaking on his behalf, his sisters asked for help in finding Meg, asking people to come forward if they had any information. His mother also spoke to the newspaper, saying that John, who had always been quiet, was now not speaking, sleeping or eating at all and was very upset and worried about Meg. Before saying he was equally as puzzled as everyone else as to her whereabouts. She ended by saying her son's life had been turned upside down and that he could not even get back into his own home as the Gardaí had it sealed off, and they also had his car. Then on Sunday the 15th of October, reports were made that bloodstained items had been found in the family home after a thorough technical examination. Then the sad news that everybody had been dreading came true. Meg's body had been found in the river shore at around 2:20 p.m. that day. It had been recovered down by the quays in Waterford City after she was spotted floating in the water by a work colleague. A boat that had been hired by Meg's employer recovered her body from the river at 3 o'clock that day. A large crowd had gathered on the quays on hearing the news. An hour after being recovered from the river, Meg's brother James identified her body. Then her family and a lot of the people that had searched for her gathered at the Woodlands Hotel, which had become a kind of a quasi-headquarters for search teams. Next, a post-mortem was carried out on her remains, which showed that Meg had died from severe traumatic injury to the upper body. She had been struck at least twice on her head, one of the blows to her right temple with a blunt instrument. Defensive injuries were also found on Meg's body, indicating that she had put up a fight. Gardaí were hoping that because she had put up a fight, they would be able to recover DNA evidence from her during the post-mortem. They also said because the attack had been so frenzied, there was little doubt that whoever had attacked her would have injuries themselves. It was reported in the newspaper that when she was found, her clothes were missing, and that Gardaí assumed they had been taken and burnt in an attempt to get rid of evidence. No motive had been established by the Gardaí yet, but they continued to appeal to the public for any information they had regarding the case. Gardaí still had control of the house and were desperately combing through it to find any evidence they could, as the court order was due to run out on the 18th of October. A number of items had been taken from the house and sent to Dublin for analysis. The search also continued for Meg's mobile phone, a Motorola, and her keys and her key fob, which were still missing. The Gardaí suspected these items had been thrown into the river at the same time as Meg's body had gone into the river. The area around the clock tower, which is situated on the quays in Waterford, was cordoned off by Gardaí after the discovery of her body, and a search of the waters surrounding that area commenced to see if any of this evidence could be found there. On Monday the 16th of October, a reconstruction of the movements of her car was reenacted. Gardaí went into every detail to ensure that the car was an exact replica, even down to using Meg's number plates. Crowds gathered on the Dunmore Road to watch as the replica car passed by, taking the journey that Gardaí assumed the car had taken to the Uluru Pub car park. They hoped that the reconstruction would jog people's memories of what had happened between 7 a.m. on the 1st of October and 1 a.m. on Wednesday, October the 4th. The Gardaí believed that after her death, Meg had been stripped and wrapped in a rug or a mat, which was tied up, this weighing her down when she was put in the water. This being the reason that her body had not been discovered earlier. The actual crime scene had not been established yet, which was really frustrating for the Gardaí and was also hindering the investigation. Then on Tuesday the 17th of October, specialist dog units from the UK were brought in to help in the search for forensic evidence, like blood, to help establish the exact location of the crime scene. On October the 19th, Gardaí released footage from the pub car park and asked for the assistance of the public as they looked for a man that had been spotted on CCTV parking Meg's car. The man was wearing a hooded top, making identification difficult. This man parked up the car and quickly walked away. Papers were saying that because of the height and size of the man in the CCTV, it was not the same man that Gardaí had as their prime suspect. Gardaí allegedly had also heard from some of the work colleagues of the prime suspect that he was actually at work at the time the car was parked up. Gardaí dismissed all these claims as purely speculative. Newspapers had been rife with speculation, some saying that an arrest was imminent, while others suggesting that the prime suspect would be at the removal and her burial the following day, and that an arrest was going to take place after her funeral had concluded. When asked if this was true, the superintendent replied he simply did not know if this person would be at the funeral, and again appealed for the person involved to come forward and give themselves up. Meg's funeral took place with her daughter, her ex-husband Coleman, and her brother as chief mourners at the top of the church, while her current husband sat behind them with his sisters. Speaking at her funeral, her brother James said Meg had died in the most violent way. He said she had always been his rock, someone that he could talk to about anything. But she would never talk about her own problems, as she didn't want to burden people. He went on to thank her ex-husband for spending 2 weeks in Waterford searching for her. He also thanked her friends and her colleagues for all their help in locating Meg, for not giving up on her and helping to find her and bring her home. He described Meg as sweet and caring, saying she was always able to speak up for herself, but now she couldn't, so it was his job to do his best to speak for her. Then on the morning of Friday, the 20th of October, a breakthrough in the case, as Gardaí arrived outside a house in Tramore, County Waterford, at 9:30 in the morning, where they arrested her husband John O'Brien under Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act. He was brought to Ballybriggan Garda Station in the city for questioning, but was released that evening after his 12-hour detention had lapsed. He remained silent as he left the Garda Station and was met by reporters waiting outside for him. Meanwhile, the river search continued as Gardaí tried to find the murder weapon. Gardaí believing they were looking for either a hammer, a mallet or a hatchet. At this stage, all the evidence was being compiled, like the CCTV footage, forensic evidence that had been taken from the house and her car, and of course from Meg, as well as witnesses being gathered as Gardaí tried to build their case against John O'Brien. It was going to take several weeks to get all the evidence together and have a file prepared for the DPP to examine to see if they had enough evidence to actually bring the case to court. They were still looking for the crime scene, which had still not been established. Gardaí checked out some derelict buildings near the bus depot where John worked to see if there was any potential crime scene there. By now, Gardaí had finished with the house and returned the keys to John, and he moved straight back in. He was rearrested on the 9th of November 2006 for questioning. Gardaí saying he was very polite, but was firm in his answers, telling Gardaí there was nothing more he could say about what had happened on the night of the 1st of October, when Meg had left the house. He was again released without charge. It would be March of 2007 before the Gardaí finally completed the file and sent it to the DPP, and another 3 months, bringing us to June 22nd, that John O'Brien would be arrested and charged with her murder and appear at Waterford Courthouse to be officially charged. He covered his head as he was brought into the building. He made no remarks when the charges were put to him that he murdered Meg at an unknown location on a date between the 1st of October and the 15th of October. He applied for free legal aid, which was granted. Meg's daughter and her ex-husband were at the hearing, which saw O'Brien remanded in custody, later to be released on bail to await the trial, which was set to take place at Waterford Courthouse in January of 2008. His legal team put in an application to have the trial moved to the Dublin Central Criminal Court, and this was granted, and the trial was then moved to April of 2008. It would eventually begin on the 14th of April, with Judge Barry White presiding and a jury of 7 men and 5 women being sworn in. A plea of not guilty was entered into the court records. The prosecution began their opening statements, saying the evidence was based mainly on circumstantial evidence. They went on to explain to the court how on the night of Saturday, the 30th of September 2006, Meg, along with her husband John O'Brien and another man, were on a night out at the Woodlands Hotel. They left the hotel in the early hours and headed back to the O'Brien's house, where an argument would break out, resulting in John O'Brien kicking the other man out. The prosecution went on to say that John O'Brien had not reported his wife missing, and that when she was found in the river 2 weeks later, it was obvious that she had died from blunt force trauma to her head. The following day, Meg's GP would give evidence. She said how Meg had come to the surgery on the 22nd of September 2006, and she told her doctor that she had been assaulted 2 days prior. The doctor said she observed swelling and bruising on Meg's hands and on her right shoulder. She said Meg was very distressed and she had advised her that she needed to go and report it to the Gardaí. Then the court heard from the man who had left the Woodlands Hotel with Meg and her husband that night. He spoke about how he had been with the two of them on the night of September the 30th. He said his wife was away that weekend and he had met Meg and John at the hotel at around 10 p.m. He said they stayed in the bar until closing and then went into the lobby where they continued drinking. He observed that Meg was in great form, said that they were all merry apart from John, who didn't seem anyway drunk and was quieter. He said they then returned to John and Meg's home for a nightcap. Meg then asked her husband if it would be okay for the other man to stay the night. He said it would be fine. The three of them then went upstairs and Meg showed him to her daughter's room where he would be sleeping. John was in another room at the time. He said they then said goodnight and she kissed him on the mouth and he kissed her back. But he said it was more of a peck and John had walked in just at that time. He said John asked what was going on and he said it was nothing. He had a little too much to drink and tried to explain it away. He said John got really angry and shouted at him to get out of his house, describing his reaction as really aggressive. He said he left the house at around 8 a.m. and headed back to his own home where he slept for the rest of the day. He said the following day he got a call from John O'Brien saying that Meg had not been seen since Sunday and that she hadn't turned up for work that morning either. He said John O'Brien asked him if Meg was with him and he told him that she wasn't. He said that he had handed over the clothes he was wearing that night to Gardaí to be tested. It was established that traces of makeup were found on his jacket and on the outside of the front of his shirt. He could not explain how this had happened. A friend of Meg's was next to take the stand. She had also been in their company that night. She had known Meg for 3 years. She had texted Meg on the Sunday to find out how the rest of the night had gone, but had got no answer. She said she then made several unanswered calls that day as well. She said she was so worried about her that she and her partner had walked over to Meg's house, and when they got there, all the curtains were closed. She also noted that Meg's car was not in the drive, but John's car was. When her employer was questioned on the stand, he described how Meg had failed to turn up for work on the Monday. He contacted his wife and the site manager, who went over to Meg's house to check on her, but the house appeared empty. When they got back and told him this, he rang a Garda friend and explained the situation to him, stating that he was very concerned for her well-being. The following day, Meg's daughter would give evidence. She said after a few drinks, the July after her mother went missing, she had texted John's sister, saying she was worried about him and wanted to help him, but needed to know what had happened to her mother. She stated she was worried that John might do something to himself and she would never find out what had happened to her. She went on to say that she regretted having sent these text messages. She told the court how she had received a phone call from John O'Brien on the 14th of October, telling her that he had the keys to the house back and that if she wanted to come over and collect her things, she was more than welcome. She had asked him if she could take some of her mother's stuff and he agreed. This was the day before her mother's remains would be found, so it would be 2 weeks before she actually got to go to the house. Next to take the stand was the colleague of Meg's who had found her body. He said after launching his boat and as he traversed the water, he noticed a man in a very distressed state pointing into the water. He went to investigate, and this is when he saw the body floating. He said he immediately recognised Meg from her hair. Some of Meg's neighbours then took to the stand, and all said they hadn't seen Meg since the 1st of October. One neighbour said how he had seen John driving his car down to some waste ground and had even made a comment to the passenger in their car that they hoped he wasn't dumping rubbish. The CCTV footage was then shown to the jury, which showed the man parking up the car at the Uluru Pub car park on the 2nd of October at around 10 p.m. It then showed him getting out of the car and walking towards the back before the rear parking lights flashed as if he was locking the car. A man who worked at a local pizza parlour that backed out onto the car park said he had noticed the car parked there. He said he first noticed it on the 2nd of October between 5 and 6 p.m, saying it was parked quite close to his shop. He said he left his shop at around 8 p.m. to make some deliveries and he noticed the car again. This time it was parked in a different area and he noticed a man sitting in the driver's seat, like he was looking for something in the glove box at the passenger side of the car. He said it was definitely a man, but he couldn't give any further details. He said he saw the car again at 10 p.m. and it was yet again parked in a different spot. He said this was why he remembered the car, because he had seen it in so many different parking spots in the car park. Then the Garda that spoke to Meg at the station on the 22nd of September 2006 took the stand. He said that she alleged her husband had assaulted her a couple of days earlier, but said she did not want to press charges at the time. Meg's solicitor then told the court that he had been contacted by Meg on the 25th of September and she had asked him to send John O'Brien a letter outlining the assault he had made on her. He said she had also asked him to write to her bank with regards to getting O'Brien off the deeds of her house and for her to take over the mortgage. She had also contacted the bank directly about this and her accountant was preparing a statement of her finances. She directed her insurance company to change the type of cover she was on. They had sent out the forms to her, but they said they had never been returned, and they were then informed that Meg was missing. The Garda that had spoken to John the day his wife went missing told the court how, when he asked John why he hadn't reported her missing initially, he had said that she had gone off before and stayed in hotels. He said that when he went to look at the house that day, O'Brien appeared very, very nervous. He said his hands were shaking and that he got very aggressive when he was trying to open the padlock on the shed. He said they had the feeling that he didn't want them there. He said that when they interviewed O'Brien at the station, they discussed the state of their marriage and also the night they had went out to the Woodlands Hotel. He said John told them that after they got home that night, he had witnessed his wife kiss the other man in their company. He asked her why she had done this and she told him that he hadn't been paying enough attention to her. He said they slept in separate bedrooms that night and he got up around 1:30 on the Sunday afternoon and had gone for a drive in his car to Tramore. And when he got back around 5, he spoke with her again about the kiss and she told him that he had driven her to it. He said he went into the living room and started watching television and heard her leave the house in her car at around 8:30 p.m. stating that this was the last time he saw her. He did admit that the marriage had its ups and downs and that they argued about money in the months leading up to Meg's murder. He went on to say that she had run up a credit card bill of 17,000 euros and since she had disappeared, he discovered that she had taken out a credit union loan of 24,000 euros. When asked about the incident on the 20th of September, he said that after they had got back from his parents' home, Meg had started to shout at him. He told her he was going to bed, but she grabbed him and he pulled her hand away. He admitted that he lost it and he hit her on the back of the head with his fist. She began screaming at him to stop, and to stop her, he put his hand over her mouth. He said Meg was struggling with him and tried to get over to an open window, but he caught her by the shoulder and pulled her back. He said eventually they calmed down and they went to bed. He said she told him a couple of days later that she had told the Gardaí about the assault and that if he ever did it again, she would bring charges against him. He said he wasn't happy that she had gone to the Gardaí and pleaded for forgiveness, saying he would never do it again. He said she said to prove it. He said Meg had wanted only her name on the deeds of the house, so he told her that if that's what she wanted, she could do it. He said they discussed the assault again about a week before she had disappeared and that Meg had suggested giving him 150,000 to leave, but he refused. saying that he had told her he didn't want to lose her. He said things had been getting back on track with the marriage by the night she had disappeared. Dr. Mary Cassidy, the state pathologist, gave evidence that Meg had died from blunt force trauma to the head, suffering at least two heavy blows to the top of her head with some type of instrument. She said she couldn't determine if a crook lock that had been given to her by the Gardaí, which had been found in one of John O'Brien's bins, was the weapon. She said the injuries to her shoulders and arms were consistent with defensive wounds. She also said that there was fluid in Meg's lungs, which would be suggestive of drowning, but the body had been in water for a long period of time, so she could not determine if she was alive when she went into the water. She said the head injuries that Meg had sustained were not survivable. Another guard that took the stand spoke at how he received a call from John asking had they found Meg's car yet, but didn't ask if they had found her. He also said that when they were searching the house, they noticed that the washing machine dial was turned up to 90 degrees, and also an upturned mattress which had a stain on it was removed and sent for forensics. The court also heard how on the day his wife was reported missing, O'Brien's phone pinged off the phone mast, which would have placed him in or around the car park area where her car had been found. O'Brien had said that day he had gone and sat outside the other man's house whom his wife had kissed for about 20 minutes. Gardaí also said they found him on CCTV at a time he said he was at home, standing on the quay in the city centre near the area where Meg's body would later be found. When asked why he was standing there, he denied it was himself. The guard went on to say that when they checked Meg's office desk, they found her marriage certificate, a deed of separation, and also forms relating to the transfer of the deeds of the house, and information on three upcoming holidays that she had planned with O'Brien. He said O'Brien denied everything that was put to him when questioned by the Gardaí, including the fact that Meg's wedding rings, which had been found in an ashtray in their home, were put there by him before he discarded her body. Forensics had found blood in the boot of Meg's car on the driver's seat and on the outside of the driver's door and the back bumper. The results showed a mixed match of Meg's and O'Brien's blood. The car mat that had been found in the field with bloodstains on it was a match for Meg's blood, as was the blood found in the boot of her car. No blood was found at the house. CCTV footage was shown to the jury of Meg's car as it made its way through the city. They were also shown footage of O'Brien's car driving around the city in the days after Meg had gone missing. The CCTV footage also indicated that O'Brien allegedly had left Meg's car in the pub car park and walked to a nearby Tesco where his own car was parked and where he got into it and drove home. Another witness stated how as they were driving past the entrance to the waterworks at Bell Lake on the Dunmore Road between 8:30 p.m. and 9 p.m. on Sunday the 1st of October, they noticed a silver car parked at the entrance. The witness said the interior light was on in the car and the door nearest the verge was open. The witness said she remembered it because she was surprised to see a car parked there and was even going to stop to see if anyone needed help. But she didn't see anyone, so she kept going. Phone records for Meg's phone showed that the last time it was used was on Sunday the 1st of October at 1:59 p.m. and pinged at the tower closest to her home. When O'Brien's phone records were examined for the Sunday, all traffic for his phone was routed through the mast near the Uluru car park. An application was put forward by the defence to have the case thrown out and dismissed, but this was denied. Then on the 16th day of the trial, John O'Brien took to the stand in his own defence. He went back over the story of what had happened in the early hours of that Sunday morning. He said he had no hand, act nor part in Meg's murder. He did admit that he hadn't told the Gardaí everything when he was questioned, stating that he had forgotten certain events and had got some things wrong. He said he never thought that the investigation would end up being a murder inquiry. He said he was often in Meg's car, which would explain away why his DNA was found in it. He said the reason he was in the Tesco car park on Sunday, the 2nd of October, was because he was watching the other man's house to see if Meg was there. He denied driving Meg's car, stating he had no motive to kill his wife. He said he knew all about the deed of transfer of the house and had only done that to prove to her that he wouldn't ever assault her again. Closing statements on the 7th of May began with the prosecution, who said the only person that had all the answers was her murderer. And despite the best efforts of the Gardaí, they were unable to establish the exact location of the crime scene or the precise time of death. They said whoever had attacked Meg had every intention of hurting her, if not killing her. And even though all the evidence was circumstantial, it pointed to her husband. They said the jury needed to put aside sympathy and emotion and look at all the evidence as a whole. They reminded the jury that O'Brien had been evasive and had not been helpful over the course of the investigation. They said he had let them into the house, but he had known that this was not the crime scene, the prosecution suggesting that the real crime scene was her car. The defence said that there was no forensic evidence in the house or in the car to prove that John O'Brien had murdered his wife. They also said that some of the times given by witnesses where Meg's car had been seen were times that John O'Brien was actually with the Gardaí. They went on to ask the jury to acquit John O'Brien. Justice Barry White gave his instruction to the jury on Thursday, the 8th of May. He said that the onus of proof of guilt was with the prosecution. He said they needed to consider that the evidence given by the defendant and the inconsistencies in his statement may have had innocent explanations. He also warned them about the risk of mistaken identity by witnesses. The jury deliberated for 3 hours that day before being sent back to their hotel. They deliberated for a further 5 hours and 20 minutes the following day before reaching a verdict. The courtroom was full, everybody eager to hear the foreman give the verdict of the jury. And a hush came over the room despite it being packed to capacity. Then the verdict was read. Not guilty for the murder of his wife. Meg's daughter broke down in tears and was comforted by her uncle. Other family members and friends of Meg's wept openly. They could not believe what they had just heard. Even two of the female jurors were crying as the verdict was read out. O'Brien showed no emotion when he heard not guilty. After the trial, the defence read out a statement on O'Brien's behalf, in which he said that he wanted the media to respect his privacy and let the family grieve in peace for Meg and for her father who had died just the year before. Her brother James also gave a statement outside the court saying the whole family was numb and devastated. He said they were at a loss to understand why this would happen to them. He said Meg had lived through a terrible ordeal and had kept it all to herself. He said all they could do now was depend on the memories that they had of her, before also requesting that the media respect their privacy. After the trial, it was learned that a letter Meg had written was deemed inadmissible by Justice Barry White because it was too prejudicial. The letter, which had not been sent or addressed to anyone, said that her husband had threatened to kill her. The incident described in the letter was very similar to that of the incident that had taken place between Meg and O'Brien on the 20th of September 2006. The only difference being that the incident described by John O'Brien was a lot tamer than the incident described in the letter written by Meg. In the letter, Meg wrote that John O'Brien had pulled her by the hair and pushed her down the stairs. He then caught her by the throat, hit her and kicked her. She thought he was going to kill her, stating at one point in the letter that she had made her peace with God and allegedly told her husband that he could go ahead and kill her. A senior investigator would later tell the papers that Gardaí had kept an open mind when investigating the murder and did not focus on any one person in particular, but gradually narrowed it down to their prime suspect after investigating several people who did not even know they were being investigated. It was later stated that the investigation was now over and Gardaí had no plans to reopen the case. Then on Tuesday the 13th of May, the Evening Herald newspaper printed photographs that had been taken outside the courthouse on the 30th of April after proceedings had adjourned for the day. It showed John O'Brien allegedly punching a photographer. He lunged at the photographer and grabbed the strap of his camera. The photographer managed to turn himself around before the punch, and said it was only after the fact that he learned that John O'Brien had a black belt in Taekwondo. He would later lodge a complaint of assault with the Gardaí. Meg's family would later take legal advice in relation to taking a civil action against John O'Brien in relation to distress caused by John O'Brien's alleged treatment of Meg. They later decided against it as the financial costs would be far too much. A few weeks after that, it was reported that somebody had smashed the windows at John O'Brien's house where he had lived with Meg. He was still living there. This was the second time it had happened, and apparently he had told neighbours he might have to consider moving abroad. An inquest was held into Meg's death in November 2008. Her brother saying at the inquest that they hoped maybe eventually whoever was responsible would come forward because their conscience told them to. He hoped someday justice would be served for his sister. Meg's daughter would go on to sue John O'Brien for a share of her mother's estate, as her mother had died intestate. She stated how he had agreed to the transfer of the property into the sole ownership of her mother prior to her death, as he had said it in the criminal trial. A settlement was reached in 2011, giving her daughter a share in her mother's estate. This being only a small consolation for her daughter, as the family have never had true justice for Meg's death. And now it seems they never will have justice, as the Gardaí are not going to reopen the case. So along with her family, we're all left questioning what happened to Meg. Do we know? Or do we think we know? The answer is we will never truly know, and that's very frustrating. So I can only imagine what it must be like for the family and for her friends. All we can hope is that whoever is responsible never has a day's peace for what they have done. So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership, and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.
You've been listening to Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. Join Newells for another episode coming real soon. And keep up to date by following our social media sites, our YouTube channel, and our website. IslandCrimesandMysteries.ie